Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're tackling Time Magazine, October 13th, 2025.
A really packed issue.
Absolutely. I'm Andy Brown, and we are going to really dive deep into this one source. It's more than just articles, isn't it? It feels like a snapshot of a, well, a pretty intense global moment.
It really does. I'm Chris Cabot, and the range here is, wow, it's huge. We're talking about everything from, you know, major political power plays in the U.S., shifts in foreign policy.
Surprising science news, even deep cultural reflections, all happening at once.
Exactly. From threats to nonprofits to drone warfare ethics in Ukraine, and then this potential discovery on Mars, which interestingly immediately hits a political wall.
Yeah, that Mars story is something else. So our goal here is to give you, the listener, a kind of fast-track, comprehensive understanding of this specific moment in time. The sources really paint a picture of a world grappling with political power being used in very specific ways.
The fragility of public trust, definitely. Mm-hmm. And these big questions about how we even define success or legacy in such a volatile time.
Okay, let's jump right in. The domestic political scene feels like the right starting point. It sets the tone for so much else.
Agreed. And the big takeaway domestically seems to be this focus on using the machinery of government tax code regulations to target political opponents.
Right. And it starts with this really significant threat facing left-leaning groups, specifically going after their tax-exempt status.
Yeah, this really blew up after the shocking assassination of Charlie Kirk. You had officials like VP J.D. Vance, Stephen Miller, openly calling for punishment against groups they blame for, you know, fueling violence.
So they're naming names, like specific foundations.
Oh, absolutely. Vance specifically mentioned major players like the Ford Foundation, George Soros' Open Society Foundations. He talked about going after this NGO network that foments and facilitates and engages in violence.
Now, targeting tax-exempt status, that sounds bureaucratic, but you said it's potentially an irreversible financial collapse. Why is it so devastating?
Well, it's kind of elegant in its potential brutality. Mm. An expert, Ofer Lyon, explained it clearly. The moment an organization loses that 501c status, two things happen. First, donors can't deduct their contributions anymore.
Which is the main incentive for large donations, right?
Exactly. Large-scale charity relies on that. So, boom, fundraising basically dries up overnight. And second, the organization itself might suddenly owe taxes on its endowment, you know, its long-term savings. That could just wipe them out.
But the legal experts in the piece suggest the real power isn't necessarily succeeding in revoking the status, is it? It's the threat itself.
Precisely. Professor Roger Colombo points this out. It's actually quite difficult to revoke status just based on political views.
Yeah.
IRS rules are supposed to focus on activity. Is the money used for charity, not ideology?
Okay.
But the threat of a high-profile IRS audit, that creates what they call a chilling effect instantly. Donors get spooked, they pull back, regardless of whether the IRS would eventually win.
So the uncertainty becomes the weapon, and the cost of fighting it
serves the same purpose as losing. It drains resources, creates bad PR. It's effective intimidation.
And wasn't there a law passed specifically to prevent this kind of political meddling with the IRS?
There was. Back in 1998, Congress explicitly prohibited the executive branch from influencing specific taxpayer audits. So technically, officials like Miller can only call for investigations. They can't legally order them.
But history shows that hasn't always stopped it.
Not at all. Patrick Eddington from the Cato Institute reminds us, the IRS has been misused politically before. McCarthy era, the Obama era Tea Party audits. The potential for abuse is there, even with that law in place. The threat feels real.
And this idea of weaponizing government bodies, it doesn't stop at the IRS, does it? The sources connect this directly to what happened with ABC and Jimmy Kimmel Live.
Yeah, that was startlingly fast. Kimmel's show gets suspended almost immediately after FCC Chairman Brendan Carr complains publicly about a monologue Kimmel did related to the Kirk assassination.
And there's context there, involving an ABC affiliate owner needing FCC approval for a merger.
Right. It suggests, well, pretty direct regulatory pressure. The chairman allegedly made a comment like, we can do this the easy way or the hard way, referring to his power over broadcast licenses. That kind of immediate compliance is unusual.
Which then seemed to encourage the president, who basically said stations giving him bad publicity should lose their licenses.
So you see the pattern. IRS for financial pressure on nonprofits, FCC for pressure on broadcast media. It's using institutional levers for political ends.
And the philanthropic world reacted.
They did. A big open letter, 158 organizations signed it. They warned that these attempts to silence speech and restrict charity fundamentally undermine democracy. they clearly see it as a systemic threat.
Okay, so from policing speech and charity, let's shift to policing economic talent. The other huge domestic shockwave in this issue is the new H-1B visa policy.
Yeah, this one really tests that tension between, you know, wanting innovation versus protecting domestic jobs, or the perception of protecting jobs.
What's the actual policy change?
It's blunt. A massive $100,000 fee for new employer-filed H-1B applications after September 21st, 2025. The administration frames it as stopping companies from replacing Americans with lower-paid, lower-skilled labor.
But the economists cited in Time, they completely disagree with that premise, don't they?
Oh, completely. Professor Giovanni Perry at UC Davis is quoted saying the idea H-1Bs take American jobs is empirically opposite to the truth. His research shows foreign STEM workers are actually an incredible engine of growth.
How so? They create more jobs.
Yeah, by driving innovation, which then creates more complementary jobs for U.S. workers. It increases the overall pie, essentially. And Subodh Kumar at Temple argues this fee will directly hurt the innovation and competitiveness of the U.S. industry. So much R&D depends on this talent pool.
And we're talking about some pretty high-profile people who came through H-1B.
Absolutely. The CEOs of Microsoft, Google, Zoom, Nadella, Pichai, Yuan all started on H-1Bs. Plus, studies consistently link H-1B workers in a region with more patents being filed, especially in crucial fields like AI.
So charging $100,000 per hire, it's like taxing innovation directly.
Pretty much. And the immediate reaction was panic in Silicon Valley. But the article highlights the huge impact on India, right? Since about 70% of H-1B holders are Indian nationals.
What's the risk there for the U.S. economy?
It's twofold, according to the analysis. Yeah. First, these skilled workers won't just disappear. They'll go elsewhere.
Mm.
The UK, Canada, places with easier tech immigration are already seeing a spike in applications from Indian tech professionals. We lose that talent.
And the second risk?
Offshoring. If U.S. companies can't hire the specialized H-1B talent they need here, the research suggests they often don't just hire an American instead. They move the entire project or division overseas. So the jobs, the R&D, the economic activity, it all leaves the U.S.
Now, there's a specific angle here about universities and nonprofits that's really critical.
Yes, this often gets missed. While universities and nonprofits are exempt from the annual cap on H-1B visas, they are not exempt from this new $100,000 fee.
And that's potentially devastating for them.
Monumental crisis territory. The example given is Harvard. They sponsor around 125 new H-1Bs a year for researchers, faculty, specialized staff. At $100K a pop, that's over $10 million extra cost annually.
Wow.
For institutions already fighting for grant money, that makes hiring top international talent for vital research almost impossible. It directly hits the foundation of U.S. scientific progress.
It's interesting, though, because even within the tech industry, there isn't total agreement on this fee, is there?
No, it's split. Smaller companies hate it, call it sand in the gears. But then you have giants like Sam Altman at OpenAI or Reed Hastings from Netflix actually supporting it.
Why would they support such a high fee?
Their argument is that it guarantees the H-1B is only used for truly very high-value jobs, not, you know, potentially lower-skilled roles that maybe could be filled domestically. It gets rid of the lottery system, which they see as inefficient.
So for them, $100K is just the cost of securing elite talent.
Essentially, yeah. For a company like OpenAI, it's manageable. But as Professor Perry points out, it creates this tension. The business leaders focused on global STEM dominance versus the restrictionists like Stephen Miller, whose goal seems to be just cutting immigration numbers, period.
That tension sets up the global picture really well, because these domestic policies obviously have international consequences. Let's look at Venezuela. The headline basically asks, is the U.S. at war?
It's a stark question. The reporting details two specific U.S.-ordered kinetic strikes, meaning attacks on Venezuelan vessels in international waters. The first killed 11 people, the second killed 3.
And the justification given by the administration?
President Trump stated they were targeting narco-terrorists and cartels, specifically naming Tren de Aragua, a notoriously violent Venezuelan gang he designated a national security threat. He claimed the ships were carrying drugs.
He even posted a video of one exploding, didn't he, claiming cocaine and fentanyl went into the ocean.
Yes. And officials like Secretary of State Marco Rubio are saying the strategy is working, that fewer suspect vessels are heading towards the U.S. since the strikes began.
But Venezuela's reaction?
President Maduro is calling it an act of war. He says relations are completely broken, accuses the U.S. of trying to provoke a major war, essentially aiming for regime change through military aggression.
which immediately brings up huge legal red flags, right? Starting with international law.
Massive red flags. Experts cited, like Michael Becker at Trinity College Dublin, stress that just calling someone a narco-terrorist doesn't automatically make them a lawful military target under international law.
So the strikes likely violate.
The UN Charter's prohibition on the use of force, which really only allows force in self-defense, and international human rights law regarding unlawful killings. Mary Ellen O'Connell argued that killing someone outside an active war zone is only lawful if it's immediately necessary to save a life, which striking a suspected drug boat probably doesn't meet.
And domestically, there's the question of presidential authority. The president reportedly used a secret directive against cartels.
Yeah, but the legality of that is highly questionable. Congress hasn't authorized military force against drug cartels like Tren de Aragua. The usual justification for unilateral action is the 2001 AOMF authorization for use of military force, but that's supposed to apply to groups linked to 9/11 or Al-Qaeda.
So extending that to drug cartels is seen as a major overreach.
A gross overreach, according to many legal scholars. It sets a really dangerous precedent for basically conducting extrajudicial executions anywhere in the world.
And that concern is shared across the aisle in the U.S.
It is. The sources mentioned bipartisan criticism. Republican Senator Rand Paul raised alarms, even invoking To Kill a Mockingbird, implying execution without trial. And Democrat Senator Adam Schiff is pushing for a war powers resolution to stop the president from, as he put it, blowing ships willy-nilly out of the water. He calls them dangerous extrajudicial killings.
Okay, so from that hot conflict zone, let's shift to a major diplomatic move in the Middle East context. The coordinated recognition of a Palestinian state.
Yes, this is significant. We're talking Britain, Canada, and Australia. Key U.S. allies all formally recognizing Palestine right before the U.N. General Assembly meets.
And this is being seen as a direct response to.
Primarily as a rebuke of Israel's ongoing actions in Gaza and the continued expansion of settlements in the West Bank. It's an attempt to signal disapproval and push for a different path.
The U.K. Prime Minister Keir Starmer gave a specific reason.
He did. He said the recognition was necessary to keep alive the possibility of peace and a two-state solution, arguing that hope for that solution is fading fast given the situation on the ground.
And this comes shortly after that UN Commission's findings regarding Gaza.
Exactly. The timing is crucial. That UN Independent International Commission of Inquiry concluded Israel is responsible for acts amounting to genocide in Gaza, citing killings, causing serious harm, creating destructive living conditions. Israel, of course, completely rejected that report.
So how did Israel react to the statehood recognition itself?
Prime Minister Netanyahu rejected it forcefully. He called it a prize for Hamas and reiterated his position that no Palestinian state would be established west of the Jordan River. For the UK especially, given its history as the colonial power in Palestine, this recognition carries particular weight. It's a strong, unified message from key Western allies.
It's interesting how these global dynamics connect back to domestic issues. You mentioned the H-1B fee causing tension with India, yet despite that, the U.S. and India seem to be quietly repairing ties.
Yeah, it's a classic case of strategic interest overriding personal friction. The initial Trump-Modi special relationship definitely cooled. India felt trust was broken.
What were the specific friction points mentioned?
Well, Trump apparently claimed personal credit for brokering the Kashmir ceasefire and wanted Modi's help getting a Nobel Peace Prize nomination, which ruffled feathers. Then came the huge 50% tariffs on India because they continued buying Russian oil.
And Modi pushed back visibly.
He did. Attending that Shanghai Cooperation Organization summit with Xi Jinping and Putin sent a clear message. India wouldn't be bullied by U.S. policy.
But now things are improving. Why?
Shared strategic goals, mainly countering China in the Indo-Pacific. That's the big one. And there are tangible steps towards a trade deal now. India apparently agreed not to demand source code from U.S. tech companies operating there, a huge win for the U.S.
Any other concessions?
They might also drop restrictions on U.S. soy imports, which helps American farmers. So you see these practical economic interests pulling them back together, even though that H-1B fee affecting so many Indian professionals remains a significant irritant.
That brings us neatly to the digital realm and the ethics surrounding technology. Let's start with the TikTok deal. Huge controversy there.
Huge. The basic structure is transferring 80% ownership of TikTok US to an American group, Oracle, Silver Lake, and Andreessen Horowitz. The key security promise is that all US user data for those 170 million users will be stored on Oracle servers in Texas.
Okay, the original fear driving a potential ban was Chinese surveillance and influence. What's the new concern with this deal?
The worry, voiced by cybersecurity experts like David Kennedy, is that it doesn't actually solve the surveillance problem. It just changes who might be doing it. He literally said, we're just basically switching one government for another.
So the fear is U.S. government access.
Exactly. Critics worry the structure might actually make it easier for the U.S. government to access user data, potentially turning TikTok into a surveillance tool against Americans.
What about the algorithm? That was a major sticking point, wasn't it? China considers it sensitive tech.
It is. The plan is for Oracle to retrain a licensed version of the algorithm, supposedly from the ground up, to ensure it's clean. But there are conflicting reports. One advisor suggested China might still retain some core control over the underlying IP.
So if the U.S. is just licensing it,
the potential for subtle manipulation or hidden backdoors might remain, even if the data lives in Texas. It's a critical, unresolved question.
And beyond the tech, there are political concerns about the players involved.
Definitely. The close ties of people like Oracle's Larry Ellison to the Trump administration are noted. Plus, the deal includes having a government-designated member on the new TikTok U.S. board.
A government official on a private company board.
Yeah. Critics say that gives the government inordinate power over the platform, raising fears the platform could be weaponized politically. Kennedy, the ex-NSA hacker, argues if we need safeguards, they should be comprehensive federal laws for all social media, not this special, potentially conflicted setup for TikTok.
It's a fascinating dilemma. And speaking of weaponizing technology, the article on Ukraine gamifying drone warfare is, well, it's both impressive and deeply disturbing.
It really is. This strategy, led by Minister Mikhailo Fedorov, is about leveraging the skills young recruits already have from gaming, and the impact is staggering. Drones are reportedly responsible for 2/3 of all battlefield deaths now.
How does the gamification actually work?
It's centered on the Army of Drones bonus program. Operators earn points for confirmed kills, 40 points for taking out a tank, 6 points for a soldier. Fedorov said tweaking the point system actually doubled the kill count in a month.
And what do they do with the points?
They redeem them for better equipment on a digital marketplace called Brave One. So rack up enough points, you get access to more advanced drones like the Vampire Heavy Bomber drone. It creates this direct incentive loop.
It allows high command a direct focus too, right?
Exactly. Need more artillery taken out? Just raise the point value for destroying Russian guns. It makes strategic adjustments happen almost in real time.
And the contrast with traditional military procurement is stark.
Hugely stark. A U.S. official is quoted calling the Pentagon system bigger and more cumbersome, more legalistic, taking years. Ukraine apparently shortened the cycle for getting new drone tech deployed to about 10 days. It's like military Amazon Prime, rewarding success almost instantly.
But the psychological aspect, the ethical distance, that's worrying.
Deeply worrying. The article mentions a unit psychologist observing that these young pilots, many raised on PlayStation, often show little trauma because the war feels more abstract to them. It's like a remote task, divorced from the immediate horror.
And the future looks even more detached, AI targeting.
Yes. They're moving towards AI-enabled targeting in new drones. And then there's this chilling thought experiment mentioned, drawing from the sci-fi novel Ender's Game, the idea of pilots potentially not knowing if they're in a simulation or real combat. But as Fedorov says, a kill is still a kill, even if an algorithm helped make the decision.
Wow. That contrast between the cold ethics of digital war and the search for truth leads us right into the next major theme. Public trust, especially in health and science.
Yeah, and this issue has a really pointed piece by an emergency doctor about how President Trump's recent statements are damaging trust in the medical profession.
What were the specific claims causing concern?
Two main things. First, he claimed, without solid scientific backing, that acetaminophen Tylenol used during pregnancy is driving autism rates. Second, he told parents to ignore CDC vaccine schedules and space out shots.
Which doctors say is actually less safe.
Right. It means more injections overall and leaves kids unprotected for longer periods. And the most concerning part was him advising pregnant women to just tough it out instead of taking Tylenol for fever or pain, based purely on what I feel.
What does the actual science say about acetaminophen and autism?
The evidence is really mixed and inconclusive. Some studies show a weak link, but others, including a massive one in Sweden with 2.5 million kids, found no link at all. Professional medical groups still recommend it because the risks of untreated fever or severe pain in pregnancy are well documented, and serious things like preterm birth.
So undermining Tylenol could push women towards riskier options.
That's the fear expressed in the article. Alternatives like aspirin or ibuprofen are known to be dangerous during pregnancy. So casting doubt on the one generally safe option is seen as incredibly reckless.
And the administration itself wasn't even unified on this message.
No, that's key. Right after the president's remarks, the FDA put out a statement saying there's no conclusive evidence linking acetaminophen and autism. But then the HHS secretary went on TV doubling down, claiming a causal relationship based on the president's feeling.
That contradiction is where the trust erosion really happens, isn't it?
Exactly. When health advice becomes openly political and contradictory, it makes people ask, who do I believe? It undermines the very idea of trustworthy expertise, which is fundamental for public health, creates long-term damage.
And it's just heartbreaking when that kind of political noise potentially overshadows a genuinely monumental scientific discovery. Let's talk about Mars.
This is incredible. NASA's Perseverance rover found something really intriguing in Jezero Crater in a rock formation called Chayava Falls.
What did they find?
Rocks streaked with unusual colors, red, green, purple, blue, and covered in these tiny poppy seed-sized dots, markings that, here on Earth, often resemble those left by microbes as they metabolize minerals.
The acting NASA administrator called it the closest we have ever come.
Yes, Sean Duffy said that. It's because of specific minerals they identified, vivianite and greigite.
And those are significant because...
On Earth, they're very often produced by microbial life, especially in watery, low-oxygen environments, like ancient lake beds, which Jezero Crater used to be. Finding them together is considered a strong potential biosignature, a sign of past life.
But it's not confirmed yet. They need samples back on Earth for that, right? Which requires the Mars sample return mission.
Precisely. You can't definitively confirm life remotely. You need to analyze those rock samples in sophisticated labs here. MSR is designed to do exactly that, bring the samples back.
And here comes the political disruption.
Right when we get this tantalizing clue, the administration's budget request slashed NASA funding by 24% and specifically canceled the Mars sample return mission.
So arguably the most exciting potential discovery in decades, maybe centuries, and the immediate political response is to cut the funding needed to confirm it.
It's almost unbelievable. A potential answer to, are we alone? Put on hold because of budget politics. It just highlights that theme again, short-term political or financial calculations, potentially derailing the pursuit of fundamental objective truth.
It's a lot to process. Maybe before we get into culture and finance, we could use those anxiety tips, time offered. Seems relevant.
Good idea. The piece acknowledges anxiety spikes at night precisely because our usual distractions fade away. So strategy one is called worry time.
How does that work?
You schedule it hours before bed. Make two lists. Worries you can control and worries you can't. You plan to tackle the controllable ones tomorrow and the uncontrollable list. You physically rip it up and throw it away. A symbolic act of acknowledging and dismissing what you can't fix right now.
Okay, what else? Mental gymnastics.
Yeah, instead of trying to empty your mind, which is hard, you distract it with a detailed, non-stressful mental task, like recalling the entire plot of a favorite movie, or playing the alphabet game with a specific category, like naming animals for each letter.
Third tip. Grounding. Using your senses.
Right. Focus intently on physical sensations. The smoothness of a stone, the coolness of water in your hands, the feeling of your bed sheets. It pulls your mind out of future worries and into the present moment.
What if you're just lying there awake?
Tip four. If it's been 15, 20 minutes, get out of bed. Go to another dim room. Do something boring. Fold laundry. Read a dull manual until you actually feel sleepy again. Don't just toss and turn.
And challenging the nighttime panic.
Tip five, recognize the 3 a.m. distortion effect. Worries always seem bigger and more urgent in the middle of the night. Tell yourself, if this is still important in the morning, I'll deal with it then. Avoid firing off that angry email at 3:15 a.m.
Good advice. And the last two are about mindset.
Yeah. Keep a comfort script nearby, a short, reassuring phrase you can read, like, this feeling will pass. And finally, reframing. Try to accept waking up sometimes as just a natural variation in sleep rather than a catastrophe. Taking the pressure off can actually help you fall back asleep.
Very practical stuff. Okay, let's use that calmer mindset to look at culture, starting with Bruce Springsteen. The article calls it The Long Journey Home.
It really delves into the contradictions in his life, doesn't it? Being this champion of the working class while being incredibly wealthy, trying to stay authentic while battling his own demons.
A lot of focus is on the upcoming film about the making of his Nebraska album, right? Deliver Me From Nowhere.
Yes, that bleak acoustic album from 1982. It captures him in his early 30s, struggling with his first major depression, constantly driving past his old childhood home, a really vulnerable period.
And the film highlights his decision to finally seek therapy.
Critically, he credits therapy with saving his life. His manager, John Landau, apparently recognized how bad it was and physically took him to the therapist. It's framed as a turning point, facing those inner struggles head on.
The article talks about the shift in his theme from Born to Run's escape narrative to something more like staying put.
Exactly. 50 years later, his focus is not running, but on standing. Finding heroism in confronting the past, confronting yourself, rather than constantly seeking escape, which was the theme of so much of his early work.
And a lot of that ties back to his relationship with his father.
Deeply. His father, Douglas, suffered from undiagnosed mental illness, likely bipolar and schizophrenia, which led to anger and silence. Bruce calls his father's late life admission, "I wasn't very good to you," the greatest gift, because it allowed for some reconciliation and helped him find stability later with his wife, Patty Shialfa. He said, "We were each other's personal projects."
But he's still politically outspoken. There's mention of a recent monologue in Europe.
Oh, yeah, a fierce one against the current corrupt, incompetent, and treasonous administration, which leads to this huge irony he grapples with.
That many in his traditional working-class audience are now strong supporters of that same administration.
Right. He admits struggling with that, feeling haunted that a good number of Americans are simply comfortable with his politics of power and dominance. It's like the country he sang about has shifted under his feet. He still drives by that old house, circling that unresolved past.
Any good news for Springsteen fans in the article?
Definitely. Confirmation of a new album coming, maybe a solo tour. And crucially, those legendary unreleased Electric Nebraska full band sessions are finally coming out this fall, plus track 3 eventually, with that famous slow cover of Dylan's I Want You.
So lots to look forward to. Staying with cultural legacy, the magazine also pays tribute to Robert Redford, who passed away at 89.
A huge figure. Actor, director, ordinary people won him an Oscar, and of course, founder of the Sundance Institute, which transformed independent film. The piece really emphasizes his career-long focus on honesty. His face, they say, could tell nothing but the truth.
His work often explored themes of integrity versus corruption, didn't it?
Absolutely. Films like All the President's Men About Journalism, The Candidate About Political Ideals. There was this through line in his work suggesting that the best parts of the American spirit could win out, that honesty mattered.
And they included a poignant quote from him.
Yes, about hope. He said, "I think you have to maintain hope because that's the only life raft you've got." Feels very relevant to everything else we've been discussing.
Definitely. And on a slightly lighter but still meaningful note, there's a piece on the Golden Girls.
40 years of watching them. It talks about why the show still resonates, that focus on deep female friendship and the lives of women after middle age, which was groundbreaking then and still feels fresh.
The author found it personally meaningful as a former refugee.
Yes, it was an escape, but also a way to understand American culture and connection. And the key insight is about their storytelling. Sophia's, picture it, Rose's Back in St. Olaf stories.
They weren't just jokes.
Not just jokes. They were how the women shared their past, their vulnerabilities, how they built intimacy and made sense of their lives together. It was storytelling as connection.
And the ultimate comfort was that image of the kitchen table.
Exactly. That open spot at the table, the cheesecake. It was an invitation to the audience, a promise of community and being loved as you age. A really warm piece.
Okay. From the warmth of that kitchen table to the perhaps colder realities of high finance. The last major piece looks at the banking industry's climate strategy.
Right. This focuses on Jamie Dimon's Scottsdale Action Forum, a very influential private gathering of finance heavyweights talking climate, but pointedly without the public hype or grandeur.
And the big takeaway is a shift in approach.
A major shift. Banks like J.P. Morgan are basically saying, we'll keep financing oil and gas because the world needs it now, and we'll build a profitable green energy finance business alongside it. They're backing away from those big, ambitious climate pledges made a few years ago.
Those pledges now look like virtue signaling.
That's the term used in the article, yeah. The new reality, hammered out in Scottsdale, is that the green transition will be driven by profit, not by philanthropy or activist pressure alone. Dimon's quote is key. Banks can't make climate loans that are going to go bad. Financial stability comes first.
So instead of broad pledges, what are they doing?
Chopping things like the Net Zero Banking Alliance commitments, which have basically stalled anyway. The focus now is on deal-by-deal decisions and something called transition finance.
What means?
Funding existing polluting companies to help them reduce their emissions rather than just divesting from them entirely. The argument is that helping heavy industry transition is more impactful than just cutting them off.
So the bottom line for the banks is that market forces and stable government policy matter more than protests.
That seems to be the clear message coming out of Scottsdale, yes. Client demand and predictable regulation are what they see as the real drivers for change in the long run.
Okay, so wrapping this all up, we've covered a huge amount of ground. From extreme political actions like the IRS threats and the Venezuela strikes,
to that massive H-1B fee changing the landscape for tech and research. All intersecting with these fundamental questions about trust. Trust in doctors, trust in tech platforms, trust in government itself.
And we saw how easily objective truth can be sidelined, right? Whether it's contradictory health advice based on feelings or cutting the funding needed to confirm potential life on Mars because of budget politics.
Well, at the same time, you see technology being used in these incredibly detached, almost psychologically damaging ways, like gamifying warfare in Ukraine.
Yet, amidst all that, the cultural pieces, Springsteen's search for grounding, Redford's belief in honesty, the Golden Girls community, they point towards a persistent human need for stability, connection, and meaning.
That tension is really palpable throughout the entire issue.
So maybe the final thought we leave you, the listener, with is this. We live in a time where even huge existential questions. Are we alone? How do we stay healthy? Get tangled up in partisan fighting and short-term power plays.
Where the pursuit of truth seems constantly under threat.
So the question becomes, in this environment, how do we actively protect that pursuit? How do we nurture human connection, defend objective reality, and hold on to what Robert Redford called our only life raft, hope?
Something to definitely think about. Thank you for joining us for the Deep Dive.
We'll see you next time.